much in the news. And I know, before you ask, I don't mean the ongoing debt ceiling negotiation. I actually don't know whether any of you are taking up on that particular morass, but if you are a fifth grade civics teacher or a first grade playground chaperone, you may be called into tension at any moment. Instead, you and I have been very much in the news since the deadline from Oslo a week ago. At first glance, of course, it wasn't about us. Friday a week ago, a pair of attacks took the lives of 77 Norwegian citizens at most recent count. And the world was quick to assume that the violence was the work of Islamic extremists. Terrorists, we called them, and for most of a full 24-hour news cycle, we played the part of the co-suffering outsider. We know how you're feeling. It happened to us, too. And then the story changed. The police arrested Anders Breivik, the self-confessed architect of the twin massacres, and he was no Muslim. Quite the opposite, in fact, the narrative went. We found out that his actions were motivated by his Christian faith, a faith that, in his hands, compelled him to a violent retaliation against what he perceived to be the encroachment of multiculturalism and secular progressivism throughout Europe. And so as the media vitriol shifted and from its usual Islamic target to a religion a little closer to home, the rhetoric from the pundits took on a new tone and careened to a new fever pitch, Breivik's Christian manifesto perhaps offering a too tempting target for the whole spectrum of political agendas. I have to admit a certain reluctance to offer even the briefest time in this pulpit any one of them. But I'm equally loath to bury my head in the sand, and so, as a single touchstone example for the morning, the voice of blogger and CNN personality Eric Erickson. A somewhat lengthy quote follows, but I don't think you'll have any trouble figuring out where he stops and I begin. Why is the left so gleeful that the Norwegian is a, quote, conservative Christian? Secular leftists and Islamists are both of this world. Christians may be traveling through, but we are most definitely not of this world. The Bible is quite on point about this. In fact, Christ commands us to throw off our ties to this world. But the things of this world love this world and hate the things of God. All of them can pile on and condemn the Christian because the Christian is just passing through, a stranger in a strange land. Now, we didn't read Romans 1 this morning, though maybe we should have, if only to remind ourselves that the gospel is the power of salvation for everyone who has faith, and not just those who behave. And so there's no question, Mr. Erickson, that even if only by the power of his confession, Anders Breivik is a Christian, and consequently a Christian terrorist. All other political labels aside, I am thankful that his ultimate fate is not in my hands nor yours. But what struck me the most about Erickson's words was the outright claim that Christians don't have to deal with the things of this world. The implication that somehow we are house guests who don't have to do the dishes. And so I want this morning to take up the question as a way of asking, what sort of Christians are we to be in the wake of such a tragedy? Can we share in Mr. Erickson's victimized defiance of the things of this world? Are we really to find solace as strangers in a strange land? Well, I do agree with Mr. Erickson on one point. The Bible is quite on point about this. But rather than join him in Exodus, where the original language of stranger in a strange land refers not metaphorically to the human condition, but literally and of note to a family of illegal immigrants, you may have heard of Moses. This morning we will take up Chestnut Hill's ongoing summer sermon series on the great prayers of the Old Testament, joining King Hezekiah in the second book of Kings, with the enemy at the gates, a leader with perhaps a similar sort of defiance on his mind. because 2 Kings 19 is not in the usual Sunday school rotation. And frankly, chapters like these are why biblical pronunciation guides were invented. But do yourself a favor and don't get lost. Don't let the unfamiliarity obscure the high drama of the moment. Hezekiah, the good, obedient king, is met with his gravest challenge. The Assyrian army has taken positions surrounding the city, and the emissary has been using every rhetorical tactic he can think of to force the people into surrender. In a last-ditch effort, he puts his thoughts to paper and writes directly to the king, "Don't be fooled by your God. Don't be fooled by promises of deliverance. Haven't you heard what we did to the last people whose gods were going to protect them? Do you even remember their names?" Now, the procedure in the royal court for such a situation would be for Isaiah, the official prophet, to make dutiful prayers of petition. But the narrator lets Isaiah be off to the side, a kind of perfunctory thing. Instead, the drama follows the king, not to the battlefield, not to the court, not to the public square, but to the temple, to the house of the Lord, into the chamber of the ark itself, into the very presence of Yahweh. "O Lord, the God of Israel, who are enthroned above the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth." Check out what this guy wrote. Can you believe the nerve of some people? You're going to just stand by and let him mouth off like that? You may not know the rest of the story, but you've read enough of the Bible to know how it goes. God hears Hezekiah's prayer. The city is saved, though, as Cindy would say, it's complicated, and you'll have to read the rest on your own time. And so, like sports radio callers the day after a win, we might not be inclined to critique Hezekiah's performance under pressure. But there's something unsettling, isn't there, about a king who, in a moment of crisis, in a moment of need, in the moment when his people need him most, disappears, retreats, hides here in the safety of the church. "O Lord, the God of Israel, who are enthroned above the cherubim," you can just picture it. He's in the inner sanctum of the temple. The cherubim aren't poetic devices here. They're the actual carvings of angels that surround the Ark of the Covenant. This is the temple that God told the kings to build as his own dwelling place. So Hezekiah has come to where God is, to defy the world of the things of man. He's turned his back. And by calling on the transcendence of his creator, he has offered his loudest protest to the chaos around him. He plays the best card he has. "You are enthroned above the cherubim. You alone are the holiest of holies. You are God alone." This is his moment of truth. The chips are down or stacked against him, whatever metaphor you prefer. And in the face of an enemy who is now publicly defying the God of Israel, Hezekiah runs into the temple and shuts the door and defies the world right back. Does it sound familiar? The things of this world love this world and hate the things of God. All of them can pile on and condemn the Christian because the Christian is just passing through. So don't get too mad at Hezekiah. We hide here all the time. It's our favorite card in the deck, and we play it as often as we can. When the going gets tough, the tough get going, but the Christian, well, the Christian isn't really of this world. So, not to be too glib about it, but our hands are clean. Chestnut Hill is getting a pottery barn. Well, this I have to see. But Camden cries out for justice and healing. Don't worry. God will reward them at the end times. I don't want to get in the way of that. The meek will inherit the earth later, right? The poor in spirit get the kingdom of heaven. Well, I don't want to bother them with the things of this world. God will sort them out soon enough. I'll keep them in my prayers, where I can make my protest heard silently. You know, come to think of it, I can even do that while I'm standing in line at Pottery Barn. answered, and his is not the only one, and it is profoundly true that prayer inherently defies the logic of the world, that it claims and calls upon a God whose power exceeds anything we can perceive. But I do mean to draw a fine line, perhaps a fine line a mile wide, between defiance of the world for God's sake and defiance of the world for our sake. A lazy retreat from a vocational call we just don't feel like answering. Here's a shorthand way to know the difference. If it's convenient, and here I use a word of some theological refinement, it's probably hogwash, which is the only way I could hear pieces of Breivik's Christian Manifesto. I quote again. I'm pretty sure I will pray to God as I'm rushing through my city, guns blazing, with 100 armed system protectors pursuing me with the intention to stop and or kill. It is likely that I will pray to God for strength at one point during that operation, as I think most people in that situation would. If praying will act as an additional mental boost, it is the pragmatical thing to do. Now, there is obviously a remarkable gap between being a boneheaded pundit and being a mass murderer. But I also hope you hear the overlapping theology between Breivik's manifesto and Erickson's victimization. The defiance of the world, either by pen or sword. Not really for God's sake, but because it is the pragmatical thing to do. A political convenience and a theological excuse. And to put myself at the risk of boneheaded punditry, there's simply no place for this in the Church of Christ crucified. So we must return to Hezekiah, whom I have left somewhat unduly vilified. You'll remember he had turned his back on the problems of his kingdom and withdrawn into the innermost parts of the temple. What seems like the most convenient theology of retreat. But then this remarkable prayer, O Lord, the God of Israel, who are enthroned above the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You made heaven and earth. First, don't let the imagery fool you. God enthroned above the cherubim, yeah, it's a familiar image, the locus of so many hierarchies of the heavens, with God transcendent over all the celestial powers, a God perhaps not on the front line, just the puppet master in the rear. But while Hebrew has words for above and below, neither of them are in this verse. Literally, God dwells the cherubim. Fill in the blank. Take your own preposition. Beneath, within, above, among, around, yes, and. Because in the second place, this is God who made heaven and earth, a God whose jurisdiction extends far beyond the context of the ark, far beyond the doors of the temple, far beyond the gates of the city. Hezekiah gets it in a way that his enemies simply cannot. There is no outside boundary to God's providence, neither in the temple, nor in the courtyard, nor in the battlefield. And to each of us, when we would each of us in those moments when we would retreat into the convenient defiance of a world in which we claim only to be strangers, let me say this as clearly as I can. There is no hiding place in heaven or in earth from God's call. We are all witnesses to the providence of the living God to whom Hezekiah prays, so I'm not telling you to get off the sidelines. I'm telling you there's no sidelines. God is not cowering in the back. God is not biding his time till the last day. And those of us who pray to the same living God must do likewise. So the good news isn't that you don't have to fight. The good news is that you don't have to fight alone. And the Bible, as it turns out, is quite unfair. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise, Paul writes to the church at Corinth. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. Friends, take courage, not in the illusion that this world is not of God, but rather in the certainty that it is precisely this, a world created for God's purposes, not without sorrow, not without brokenness, not without tragedy, and truth never more evident than in the aftermath of Oslo. But this is what the cross means, not only that God created the world, but that even despite the sorrow, even despite the brokenness, even despite the tragedy, God claims us as his own. Yes, the gospel offers no place to hide. It affords us no Harry Potter cloaks of invisibility. It arms us with no legendary wands to be masters of our own universe. But what we have is a resurrection stone, rolled away. Final sign that God's lordship over this world cannot be defied. So what sort of Christians are we to be in the wake of the dateline from Oslo? The answer is simply this: defiant ones. Christians who defy injustice. Christians who defy intolerance. Christians who defy idolatry, who defy violence, who defy hatred for God's sake. Christians like the 11 arrested Friday in the Capitol Rotunda for praying in defiance of budget proposals, who know full well the link between economic stratification and the kinds of intolerance that Breivik espoused. Christians like those involved in the Partnership to End Gun Violence here in Philadelphia, a group that knows equally well that God's call to justice sometimes requires taking to the streets. Christians like Lutheran priest Henri Fromvik, who joined with a Muslim imam to carry the casket at the first funeral for one of Breivik's victims. A defiant stand against the hatred and fear that could otherwise